to push anything through before the new council gets into place? Like, I understand the Bombay project, Terrace Point are coming up.
Well, Bombay will probably be put on hold because Measure G seems to be passing. Mm-hmm. So at least the greenbelt portion of Bombay will not be developed, hopefully. But there is one parcel that the same person owns, which is on the end of, I forgot what it's called, Ocean View Terrace or something like that, but it's right there at the edge of town, right next to what's called the Bombay parcel, and he wants to put apartments in there. They could vote on that issue before the new council seated, which would be a real mistake in my book. I think that they shouldn't vote on anything important. Maybe they shouldn't vote at all. Maybe they should just, you know, have some, like, pat themselves on the back meetings or something. Mm-hmm. You know, they could sit up, the Rock can sit up there and go through his whole life and tell us all the great things he's done, except for...
And they can play Lord of the Flies.
Right, you know, and...
Comment he made, of course, at the last city council meeting when he felt that he had been unfairly maligned and harassed by the sign-pulling controversy where he was accused, along with Rutkin, of improperly taking down signs on a piece of property, and there was a whole brouhaha about that. I could have told them that both Rutkin and Kennedy destroyed signs made by homeless people back in 1996 that were posted at City Hall, and people who want to know about that should read the current Street Shit Sheet.
Well, one of the problems with the sign thing is that it didn't stop with Rockin' and Kennedy. Is that it continued on right up until today. This morning, I witnessed one of Linda Steinau's campaign workers kicking down a number of our candidate's signs and putting up a Linda sign. I went up and confronted her, and she refused to put our signs back up.
Where was this?
This was on the corner of Escalona and Bay, right there where the median starts going up the hill there.
Is this public property?
Public property in the middle of the road on the median strip. And Phil Barry put those signs in a few hours earlier. I came down the hill from campus on my bike. I saw this woman going towards them with a Linda sign. So I stopped a block away and watched her. When she was pounding the sign in, she kicked down all the other signs within her reach while she was putting up Linda's sign. And when she got done, she went over and tore down the other sign that was too far away to do while she was standing where she was.
How do you know she was a Linda Steinau campaign worker?
Because she was putting up Linda's signs.
Did you know who she was? Did you ask
her? No, I asked her what her name was. She refused to give it to me, but I wrote down her license plate number, and when I did that, she peeled away. And before she took off, I said, you know, why are you doing this? This is ridiculous. She goes, well, this has been happening all over town. I said, oh, so you're admitting to tearing down signs all over town? She goes, no. It was the other people that was doing it all over town. I said, well, you just said you were doing it all over town. And but anyway, and then...
looks like it hasn't had much impact. The majority is getting stronger for Fitzmaurice, Crown and Sugar, at least at 11:15.
Yeah, it seems that way. And also, yesterday, Phil Baer and Fred Geiger were down on Front Street putting signs on telephone poles. And there was some supporter of Steinau following them down the road, tearing them down as soon as they could put them up. Finally, Fred Geiger called the police, right, because they couldn't talk rationally with this person to get them to...
Who was the person, you know?
No, nobody knows who they were, because I guess once the police got there, they just, like... Well, they took him aside, and so Fred and Phil never found out what the guy's name was, but he was obviously a little confused about what the legality was of putting up political signs.
Or of tearing down political signs.
Well, you're not supposed to be able to do that until 10 days after the election. I mean, within those 10 days, the campaigns are supposed to take them all down. Anything that's left after the 10 days, then the general public can tear them all down.
Maybe he was taking or tearing a page from Hernandez's book, who, as we know, was a very ardent tearer downer of signs at the Harley-Davidson dealership. You may remember he did about $4,000 worth of vandalism to that dealership, but for some reason was never prosecuted.
Well, I think part of why he wasn't prosecuted was because he voted yes for the Harley shop, even though he claimed when he got elected he was going to support the East Side. He was going to be Mr. East Side because nobody from the East Side's ever been on the city council in 25 years. So he was going to be Mr. East Side, stand up for the people of the East Side. When the people of the East Side said no Harley Davidson dealership in our part of town, Hernandez voted for it. And I think that's because they were going to sue his ass if he didn't vote for it. So he voted for Harley-Davidson, no lawsuit.
Under duress, perhaps.
I don't know if it was duress. I think it was just, he was just afraid of being sued. He was going to lose.
Well, we know that D.A. Art Danner apparently is being kicked upstairs to a judgeship. And, of course, some of us have been suggesting that Celia Scott run for D.A., or possibly the judgeship. But, of course, she couldn't get that under the current regime, I would imagine. But why didn't the D.A. prosecute this clear act of vandalism by an individual, namely Hernandez?
Well, I think there's a lot of complicity there. I mean, first of all, Art Danner is basically in the same camp with those guys, even though he's a little bit more of a right-wing reactionary than any of them are. I mean, for years, I would say Rockin and Kennedy probably weren't friends with Danner, but I'd say at this juncture in their existence, they probably are good friends with Danner. And that being the fact, I think whatever was worked out between Harley-Davidson and Hernandez was probably facilitated by Danner. He probably said, listen, you know, you guys don't want to hurt poor Michael. He's just, you know, he got a little carried away there, you know, and it's just like, you know, he didn't really mean it, and he'll vote for you.
And he did.
He did. Yes, he did.
We're all speculating here, folks. We don't know. It could have been that Art had nothing to do with any of this. I mean, I don't know that he did. What should people be looking for in the next week? There's a planning commission meeting, what, tomorrow and the next day, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's something to do with Terrace Point, I believe.
How much about that, those issues?
All I know is that there's been a lot of the TPAN, which is the Terrace Point Action Network, there's been a lot of opposition to this plan. Nobody that I know of is against having a marine research facility on the west side. Mm-hmm. What they're against, too, is having restaurants, hotels, shopping centers, and housing. Because if you build a marine research center where it's proposed to be built, and then 10 or 15 years down the road it needs to double in size, where's it going to double into? The only place it can go is into the ag land, which it's not supposed to. So it would be better...
What's the ag land?
Well, right now it's Brussels sprouts fields, you know, north of town there. And it's not actually, it's not in the city, it's beyond the city limits. So the city would actually need to expand, or the marine research facility would expand outside of the city limits into ag land, which most people don't want, the coast, especially the coastal ag land, to revert to anything other than ag land. And so I think the big thing with Terrace Point is to cut out everything except the research facility. Let's just have an ocean research facility. Let's do that. And then see, 10 years from now, if they need to double, let them double, because there'll be space to do it in. Where these apartments are supposed to be, where the shopping center is supposed to be. That's the perfect place for an expanded research facility. Let's not clog up that land with unnecessary stuff right now. Let's save it for more oceanic research.
We're talking to Scott Graham, who is active in a number of environmental issues here in Santa Cruz, as well as a sandal-wearing hippie type. Scott, what issues, if any, do you think you're going to find yourself somewhat more radical on than the current city council, if we do get these new three candidates in, Fitzmaurice, Crown, and Sugar?
Well, I think myself, I think that unless we can get some kind of support for trying to get back this Thailand, I'm sure they will be supportive of if they have the authority to rescind that vote, but I'm not sure if they will have that authority. So if they don't have that authority, I think they're going to need an indication from the public that that's what the public wants in order for them to get behind it, because I think it's a very touchy situation right now. A lot of the big-name politicians like Fred Keeley and Sam Farr didn't want to even touch it before the election. Now that the election's over, they may be willing to weigh in on the issue. But before the election, they didn't want to weigh in on that issue because anything like that could be construed as anti-business. Even though the business is anti-public lands, if you do anything to hurt a business, especially just before an election, then that could be very detrimental, you know. So I think that the public needs to rally to get our tidelands back. And not just the 6-acre park lot, the whole damn thing. If the boardwalk wants to stay where it is, they better start paying rent.
What about this Mercy Housing project? There's some people who feel that Habitat for Humanity should be involved, not Mercy Housing. Has that been locked into place?
Well, the Mercy Housing project is not a done deal. It's not, they haven't even acquired the property that they want to build on. There's a lot of resistance to them removing housing to build new housing. A lot of people want them to build whatever they're going to build on already existing vacant land in the beach flats instead of taking down some housing, most of which is up to code. I think there's only one house that's questionable in the area where Mercy Housing wants to build. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to take out housing which is up to code to put in new housing. It'd be better to put it on land that's vacant already. And the Habitat for Humanity idea is great. I think since we have a redevelopment agency and they just got the authority through this passing of the Beach South Laurel Plan to condemn and take property, they should take all the property owned by the boardwalk that's within the confines of what's known as Beach Flats, turn it all over to Habitat for Humanity, and build about 50 single-family houses down there.
For that to happen, what would be required to make up of the redevelopment agency, and could that happen?
Well, with the current director of the redevelopment agency, I don't think it could ever happen. Hopefully, that'll be one thing that will happen very soon after our guys get seated in office, is that they will either dissolve the redevelopment agency entirely or fire the director and hire a new one.
Now, how about the city manager? There's been a lot of talk that Dick Wilson has been here 20 years too long. Think there's much chance of Dick being fired by the new triad?
No, because it takes 5 votes to change the city manager. And if we get 3 guys on with Catherine, that's 4 votes. They would have to work on one of the other council members to get them to go along with it. And I don't think that's possible. I don't think Rocket would go along with it. I don't think Matthews would go along with it. Hernandez may be the weakness in the new minority. He may be the one that they're going to be able to, like, once in a while, they may actually be able to get 5-2 votes with Hernandez jumping over to our side, because I think he wants to change. If the new majority happens, Hernandez may at times join them to try to bolster his own re-election in 2 years.
Now, what other votes will require 5-2 votes that are crucial votes?
Well, the other, I think, to change the city attorney, that's also a 5-vote. It's necessary to have 5 votes to change the city attorney.
How about the chief of police?
The chief of police, I think, it's just a simple majority can change the chief of police. Myself, I think that the police department really needs some reining in, and I hope our guys can do that also. And that may be something, another thing that the people in the community will have to become very vigilant about, is that we need a more responsive police force, we need a more responsive police oversight committee, or whatever they're called, because right now,
Citizens Police Review Board.
Citizens Police Review Board, we need one that has teeth. Right now, we have a toothless police review board. We need one with teeth that can actually suspend, that can actually fire, that can actually prosecute. We don't need one with no teeth that can't do anything except make proposals.
It might require an amendment to the city charter to get that done.
Well, that would be the kind of amendment I would go for. I really don't like amending constitutions or amending city charters that much, because I think, you know, people a couple hundred years ago had a lot more clear vision about what was going on than people nowadays do. But something like that, you know, to give this agency some teeth would actually be an amendment I would go along with.
Well, listen, Scott, I don't want to stop you, but I'm going to stop you because I'm tired. But I would really encourage you to, hoping you'll be able to give kind of a part two of what needs to be done, what's in the offing, what the public should be alert to be doing in the next couple of weeks to make sure that the right or the left changes are made.
Right. Well, I think one crucial thing is to just come to the city council meetings and the public hearings in the next 2 weeks to tell them, to go right, tell them right to their heads that don't make any decisions. Don't do anything, you know. Any of these big decisions that can be made within the next 2 weeks, put them off. Let the new council decide these things. You know, why should a lame duck council make crucial decisions? It's not right.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. Thank you, Robert.
With us on the air today, we have none other than community activist Phil Baer. Hi, Phil.
Hello, Robert.
And you sound like you're a little under the weather there, Phil.
Oh, I've been working hard, but that's another story.
Well, your work in the last couple of months seemed to have produced a new city council.
I'd like to think that I played a role there. Yeah, thanks.
What's your prognostication, as we say? We have a council meeting coming up on Tuesday. Have you looked over the agenda?
No, I haven't gotten to it. Anything hot?
You know, I had the agenda, and I was kind of hoping to get the update from our council watcher, David Silva. And David's kind of been under the weather, and I'm hoping we'll still get a call on the air from him. Any sense of, I know the major issue that you were concerned about, given the fact that we have a new city council that presumably can turn back some of what the old council has done in the beach boardwalk giveaway, is still this Tidelands vote giving away the 6 acres or much of it to the beach boardwalk.
Right.
Any thoughts on what's to be done around that issue?
Well, there's a certain amount of uncertainty as to exactly what needs to be done to reverse it. I think there's definitely the will. This new council majority, as I understand it, would never have agreed to that conveyance of city interest in the Tidelands. That's why it was done in that hurried manner that it was done in. How it gets undone, I don't know. There's several, there's the legal possibility, a writ of mandamus having to do with things like the city's violation of its own charter in conveying interests back to the state without a
vote of the people.
That one seems very clear cut. And then, of course, at the state level, we now have a totally new situation with Gray Davis as governor, Cruz Bustamante and Kathleen Conley are the three people who will be over the State Lands Commission. That's quite a different cast than Wilson and Lundgren.
Now, is there any 11th hour rush job that can be done before these people take office?
I don't know. There's people are just sort of recovering and rehabilitating from the campaign and looking into exactly how these things are done the present or the new council can do by way of reversing about a half a dozen very hurried and unlikable actions that the outgoing council took in just the last few weeks before the election. How that will be done, I'm not clear on at all, but I think there's definitely the realization that some tidying up has to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything in particular you want us to watch for, any meetings you want us to attend, anything you want us to be aware of?
Well, it's a new council, but it's no reason whatsoever to lay back and let the politicians take it, even though I'm very optimistic about these three guys that just got elected. I have a lot of confidence in all of them, but Voltaire wasn't whistling Dixie with that power corrupting thing, and there's no exemption for progressives, so I'm certainly urging the public to stay right on top of the issue and hold their nose to the grindstone on all these issues. It's really got to be the public that runs City Hall. That's what happened in the last few years, and it was nigh catastrophic when the public took for granted that their boys in office were going to do the right thing and just sat back and let them have at it. They almost lost control of this city in a way that could have become damn near irreversible in short order. The recovery, the counter-revolution that occurred as of this election and with regard to the beach area plan was frankly damn near miraculous, and I don't think you can count on being able to come from behind that way every time. You better stay a little bit more on top of it from the get-go.
I tend to agree with you there, Phil. I'll get back to you by phone if I hear of any particularly egregious items coming up on the agenda.
Oh, please do. I go for those egregious items.
They're coming up on, I guess, Tuesday. We have the last full-fledged blowout of the lame duck council.
Yes, it'll be interesting. A lot of people are debating as to whether to win magnanimously or whether to rub it in their faces a little bit, or at least try to define just what went wrong by way of hopefully preventing it from happening in the future. So Tuesday's council meeting ought to be pretty interesting.
Will we be seeing you there, Phil?
Oh, yeah. I think that there are things that need to be said.
Well, then, let's all get together, and I
please
invite
do.
Listeners to join us at the council meetings. I guess 3:30 and 7 are the council meetings.
Yes, I would imagine that I don't know what the agenda is, but unless you find something hot on the afternoon session, I would assume that the 7 o'clock session would be the one where the public may choose to express a few thoughts about the situation.
That's true. 7 o'clock has the oral communications period, although during the afternoon session you can pull an item off the consent agenda and speak about it if you turn in a card.
Yeah. Well, if you find anything egregious on that afternoon session, give me a call, will you?
I'll do that.
Otherwise, I'll see you at 7.
All right.
Very good, Robert.
Thank you, Phil.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And that, of course, was community activist Phil Baer of the Beach Area Working Group, as well as a number of other groups. About a month ago, as the Street Spirit deadline neared, that's the homeless newspaper, or one of the homeless newspapers that I write for, I got a call from an activist up in Albany, a UCSC student, talking about an impending eviction of a homeless community on the Albany waterfront. Let's hear that interview now.
Okay, we're with smoke criminal Z-Man.
Somebody shoot the tape recorder. I seem to have the wrong interview on. Let's try one more time. Maybe we'll do it right.
Line with UC students. Is that where you're from, UC? Or?
Yeah, University of California, Berkeley.
And you're also a filmmaker.
I suppose.
Your name is Patrick Reddington. And Patrick, give us some of the background of the unusual situation you encountered in Albany.
All right. Well, I've lived in Albany for about a year, and just this weekend I was looking for a good place in the East Bay to view the Blue Angels. Drove out past this racetrack across from the freeway to an area I'd never been before called the Albany Waterfront. And it's a little peninsula of land that sort of juts out into the bay. And from the tips of this, there are million-dollar views of the Golden Gate Bridge, all of Marin, and downtown San Francisco and the Bay Bridge. It's an incredible view. And so we were out there watching the Blue Angels, and we're learning a little bit about the history of this place.
The Blue Angels are a bunch of planes, right?
Yeah. They're the F-18s of the Navy. You know,
sort of an air show.
Yeah, it was the air show because it was Fleet Week. And it turns out that this land, which wasn't really land at all, used to be an industrial dump. People in industry from all around the Bay Area would come and throw their waste products into the bay at this location. And for years this was going on, I think decades, until in 1984 a law was passed prohibiting any further dumping into the bay there. Pretty soon after that, life started to appear there. Grasses started to grow on the concrete and waste products that were all there in a huge pile. Birds started to nest there, and sea life started to come back to the area.
And human life as well?
Well, that, I think, comes a little bit later. So my friends and I were thinking, wow, what a very surreal place, because you can see out of the concrete and the wiring and all sorts of the bricks and things that are still there, there's grass and trees growing, and it's become sort of a wilderness area with concrete and all sorts of wiring jutting out from beneath it. It's a very surreal place. And we thought, you know, we should make some sort of film here, some sort of maybe post-apocalyptic fictional story. But the more we walked around the area, we realized there were people living there. And evidently it's a bunch of homeless people who had come and set up sort of tent encampments all around the peninsula, which is looks like a wilderness area. You know, it's not your traditional picture of a mowed lawn park and a baseball field or anything like that. It's kind of a wild peninsula.
How large is it?
Goodness, I'd say you can definitely, walking around it is at least a mile around, I'd say. Walking all the way around it. It's not a very large piece of land, but it's big enough to comfortably house about 25 to 50 people who are living out there. Mm-hmm. What happened was these homeless people used to live behind the racetrack in Albany. There's a horse racetrack, Golden Gate Field. And the city came and said, you have to move, but you can go onto this land over here, the Albany Waterfront, and we won't mess with you.
When was that, you know?
Huh?
When was that?
That was, I think, at least 7 years ago. And this is according to the mayor of the Albany Waterfront. They have developed a whole society of homeless people out there.
What's the name of the mayor?
His name is John Paul.
John Paul.
Hmm?
Is there a way he can be reached?
He lives out there. None of them really have phones. But they all kind of reside out there. They've developed a whole community. There's about, they estimate maybe 25 people living out there, and other people who live there intermittently. Mm-hmm. And what has developed is just a bunch of people have come out there, and a lot of them are actually artists, you know, homeless people, but they've made a bunch of art to beautify their campsites and their campgrounds. They have little shacks that they've built out of some pieces of wood, and they've got tents that they live in, and a lot of them have made art around their campsites, and also around the whole peninsula. You'll see little lattice works and string art forms coming off of all this rusted steel wiring.
Are this men, women, and children, or?
I haven't seen any children, but there is a guy named Brad who lives out there and met his wife out there, and they're married and live together out there.
Uh-huh.
In just a tent setup. And he's lived there for 2.5 years.
They have telephones, hot and cold running water, satellite discs?
They don't have any telephones. They don't have hot and cold running water. They do, however, have battery-powered radios, and one guy even has a battery-powered color television.
Wow.
So they have a really nice setup out there, and over the years, sort of a community has developed.
How do they deal with sanitation?
Evidently, well, they have, like, I think they dig for feces and hide that away, and, you know, pee in the bushes. But it's a big place, and it doesn't ever really, you know, have a holy stench to it or anything like that. They do have some of them, the people called the Flatlanders, I'm gathering, just in the last few days being out there, have a lot of dogs that they use, you know, they're personal pets, and they also protect their campsites. A bunch of dogs and cats that, and which weren't originally strays. This one guy, Dave, used to live in a house just down the street in Berkeley, and due to some serious health problems, he had had two heart attacks, and plus he's asthmatic and diabetic, couldn't afford to take care of the house anymore, and so it was taken over by the bank, and he was left homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been homeless for 2.5 years, and he said something really poignant to me about how he used to come to this spot and, you know, throw his waste there, you know, throw trash there, because it was basically kind of a dump to the bay, and now he's living on it. And it's just remarkable to me that here we have society's waste been tossed into here, and then when it stops, nature takes over. And then the people, who a lot of people in society consider to be just human waste, have moved in there too, and they're absolutely beautifying the place. What they have out there is incredible. There's lots of little art pieces around, and they've developed the whole community away from the mass of urban society, but yet right next door. And the views they have are absolutely incredible. The sunsets out there are probably some of the best in the bay.
Now, are these people who are, should we say, working 9-to-5 jobs, or what is their...
I don't think any of them are full-time employed, but some of them do have jobs. There's a couple people who work for, like, part-time contractor jobs, and there's one guy who I think does some work for landlords in apartments, you know, on a part-time maintenance basis. But none of them, at least none of the ones I've met, are full-time employed. But that I haven't met everyone, so I can't necessarily say that there aren't some out there. I know that there's one man out there who I've heard a lot about, but not yet met, who was a stockbroker, and through some circumstances became homeless, and now he lives out there, and he's lived there for I think 7 years. He's one of the old timers out there.
Now, is this part of the Albany city area?
It's called the Albany Waterfront, and it's part of Albany City, but I think the jurisdiction for what's occurring now falls under the Water Control Board, you know, Water Quality Control Board. And the phone number for the person who was whose name was given as someone who you could talk to about the relocation of campsites is a 415 area code. He's based at Catullus Development Corporation, the owner of the property.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who are going to, I think, be proceeding with the evictions...
Now you say there was an eviction. I kind of jumped to that. Give us a sense of, you came upon this community and you learned that there's some plan afoot to disperse these people, to run them off?
Yes, that's true. Right as you walk up to the place, you get, you know, maybe 100 yards in. Intermittently, you see these yellow signs posted on the, you know, signposts into the ground that say this area is scheduled for excavation because the property owner is transferring it to the East Bay Regional Park District for use as a state park. Your campsite and their belongings must be vacated by Tuesday, October 13th, which was just a couple days ago. These signs were not posted months in advance or anything. I think it was days in advance these signs were posted.
Mm-hmm.
And pointed to people, evidently it's not quite everyone on the island, everyone on the peninsula who's being evicted yet, but it's a goodly number of them. And a lot of those people have dogs. And I think the Albany police are going to ahead and proceed with the eviction, and the dogs will be impounded and destroyed. But that can certainly be prevented.
Now, the Albany police would think would not have jurisdiction if it's not, the city of Albany territory.
I think it's the city of Albany's property.
I see.
But the project itself is under order from, I think, the Water Quality Control Board.
And you say they're planning to move in, seize and destroy property, and kill animals?
Yeah. That was scheduled to take place, I think, at 5 o'clock on October 13th. My knowledge has not yet occurred. We've been out there daily because this story is just absolutely incredible to me, and I wanted to make a film about it.
How many days have you been filming?
I started on Monday evening.
So that's Monday the 19th?
Uh-huh. No, Monday the, Monday was not the 19th, it was the 12th, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking ahead here.
Yeah, you're a week ahead, aren't you? And looking ahead for these people, they have very uncertain futures. I was talking to one guy, Dave, who's the owner of four or five big dogs who some would say look awful and vicious. But he released them when I was in his campsite, and they were just as friendly as can be. And I have a little bit of footage that shows how friendly the dogs are. He is very, very upset about it, and a lot of people out there are, because they don't know what they're going to do. They've been given no other option and no other place to go, and their animals don't appear to have any options. And really, for some of these people, their animals are their only family.
Do these people have vehicles?
No, they don't have vehicles.
And are they disabled, these folks, anyway?
A couple of them are veterans and have serious health problems. One of them, like I said, has diabetes and has had two heart attacks, so he has heart trouble and he's asthmatic. And they are getting some treatment. I don't know about everyone, but some of them are getting treatment through federal assistance programs and veterans assistance programs. They're not all the healthiest people, because healthcare out there is pretty difficult to administer.
Mm-hmm. So you said that there are ways you think that this eviction can be stopped.
Yes, I think there are ways, because evidently if you've been on, I'm not quite familiar with the California law, but if you've been on a property for up to 7 years, I think 7 years is the limit, this threshold of eminent domain, according to Larry Hilgus, who was the attorney I spoke with about this. And if they've been there for 7 years and have been taking care of the land, which they certainly have been doing better than society has been. I mean, society was using it as a dump. They've certainly been taking care of the land. Then they might be entitled to eminent domain, and the property might be theirs.
You mean adverse possession? They might have sort of squatter's rights.
Yeah, squatter's rights.
Now, if people want to support this group of people, what can they do to help? Should they give you a call? Should they call, I guess, Mr. I see you mentioned the man named Jim Adams of the East Bay Water District has ordered this removal?
Right. They could call Jim Adams, and here we run into a problem. Because the number that was posted on these signs for these people to call for more information, at least since I've been calling it, which is Tuesday, has been just an automatic number into a voicemail.
Well, you know, that sounds like the infamous sinking stone Steinau Day Center Duchess Karen Gillette plan of real change, not spare change. You may remember the plan to give out little slips of paper to homeless people rather than quarters or dollars or dimes, because money, as we know, and homeless people just don't go well together. I mean, that's proven, I think, time and time again. They had lots of little numbers on the back of those cards, supposedly services you could call, that got all kinds of interesting answering machines. You get to spend more and more 35 cents to the phone company, but you get less and less help. Go to Fresno, I guess, is the answer to some of the city council members are suggesting, and perhaps some of the people in the Downtown Association as well. That was an interview, by the way, with an Albany activist, a student actually, who was sort of a video journalist doing his own work, who got involved. The update on that whole thing, by the way, we heard a couple weeks ago, or a week ago actually. That interview was from mid-October. We heard a week ago from the activist who you've been listening to that the city has stopped its plan to evict the homeless people there. Instead, they're simply working on cleaning up a part of the toxic area. Apparently part of the area was at one point a toxic dump. Most of it was not. And they're cleaning it up. There are some problems because they're putting in roads that are producing kind of a treacherous situation for the homeless people, most of whom use bikes or walk. But they have not pursued, after apparently some outcry and some news coverage, this original plan, if that's what it was, and it seemed to be that's what it was, to relocate this homeless community on the Albany waterfront. So I'd like to claim that as a victory. Not quite clear all of the details as to what happened, but you got some of the opening shots there, and we'll be giving you updates as we move along. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrop Spear Robert Norse. This is your twice weekly civil rights show, once on Thursdays at 6 in the evening, once on Sundays at 11 in the morning. I was talking to activist Phil Baer about the city council agenda. Dead on David Silva, our sometime City Hall correspondent, isn't feeling too well today, so we aren't going to be able to get an update from him, but I have actually, at great cost, obtained a copy of the City Council agenda, which, by the way, any of you can get. You can either go to the library to look at their copy. It's usually there by Friday evening, and the library is now open on Saturdays and a few hours on Sunday, I think from 12 to 4, maybe 12 to 5. And, or you can get it at the city clerk's office. Anyway, the update here is that the afternoon session of the November 10th city council meeting has a couple of interesting things. It has the liability claims, that is to say, claims against the city. Whoa. Here's a motion to approve. This has got to be wrong. I can't believe that they're going to approve the claims in an unspecified amount of Brian, Laurie, and Hannah Andrus. Must mean that they are not approving the claims, and I'm just having some trouble with the wording in this consent agenda item. The three Andruses are, of course, the Brian Andrus was shot 5 times, and he's again going to trial for assaulting police officers, a felonious assault with his baseball bat after cops invaded his home to protect his wife by shooting bullets around the nursery of their daughter, Hannah. And this is going to be on the city council's consent agenda. They're suing the city. There's numerous items. There's a large $400,000 payment to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. That's item 8 on the consent agenda. The reason this is significant to all you beach boardwalk watchers is that one of the reasons that Kennedy, Rotkin, Matthews, Hernandez, and Campbell were so quick to give away the Tidelands on the 7th of October, I guess the 6th of October, and then confirmed that on the 20th, they claimed they had this big reforestation grant from the Army Corps of Engineers that unless they moved immediately to give up all this public Tidelands to the essentially to the beach boardwalk via the state, that they would lose the Army Corps of Engineers grant. Well, this is a $421,000 loan to finance the Army Corps of Engineers project. So the grant was about $300,000, and here's the city paying $400,000 to the Army Corps of Engineers to do some work on the river. You know, I am not knowledgeable enough to start crying foul in a loud voice, but I find myself wondering just what's going on here. There's also a couple other items on the agenda. There's a resolution changing the Soquel Front parking lot time limit from 3 hours to 2 hours. Forget going to the movies and parking in that parking lot if you're a car person. Then there's some communications about a policy priority regarding services to homeless people by the City of Santa Cruz from the Social Services Subcommittee, which is Rotkin, Hernandez, and Kennedy. What a trio. They got lots of great mission statements, but they've still got a law criminalizing poor people and making it illegal for them to sleep after 11 o'clock at night. This evening, there will be less than 30 spaces for homeless people in emergency shelter programs. That's less than 30, folks, for 500 to 1,500 homeless people. It's a number that you who've listened to the show have heard many times, but it is boggling, mind-boggling. That's Kennedy, Hernandez, and Rotkin wasting their time on mission statements instead of finding more shelter or decriminalizing sleeping. Looks like we're going to have to do that decriminalizing, hopefully, by contacting city council members. Now, I promised you I'd get you the city council members' numbers. I found the most effective way I had of communicating with council member Chris Krohn was, strangely enough, through the city council itself, even though he hasn't actually reached the point where he has officially been appointed. You can, I believe, still call the city council at 429-3550, and you can call it, that's a 24-hour number, and leave a message for Krohn, Fitzmaurice, and or Sugar, and ask them what is their timetable for ending the sleeping ban, specifically, and have them call you back. What is your timetable, Fitzmaurice, Krohn, and Sugar, or if you don't even remember their names, say the three new council members, this goes to the three new council members, please tell me what your timetable is for ending the sleeping ban. Or if you don't remember that, and that's too many names to remember, let's remember one name, Byers, Birdseed Byers. She'll probably be the new mayor. Ask her what is her timetable for ending the sleeping ban and for guaranteeing that people who sleep in the winter outside will not be arrested, ticketed, or harassed into unsafe places. Why is this important? Well, for those of you who read the San Francisco Chronicle, there's a particularly gruesome story in the Saturday issue of the Chronicle. It reads as follows. San Francisco Throat Slasher Stalking Homeless by Jackson Van Der Becken. Experts scrutinize symbols written with victims' blood. A throat slasher who preys on homeless people and leaves behind Asian language symbols scrawled in blood is being sought in the killing of a woman in San Francisco's Mission District and two similar attacks in a Nob Hill alley, police said yesterday. We obviously have concern about the safety of the homeless, San Francisco Police Captain Kevin Dillon said. The most recent victim was Sheila Dillahunty, who was killed earlier.